The Minnesota House of Representatives Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform will come to order. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Present.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Edelson. Representative Edelson. Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Cleavorn.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Lucero.
Shamrock shakes are available.
Representative Mueller.
Okay, so now I want a shamrock shake.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, present.
Representative Pinto.
Present.
Representative Poston.
Present.
Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh, present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang. Representative Zhang. Representative Edelson. Representative Zhang. That concludes roll call with 17 present.
Very well. A quorum is established for today. This hearing is being conducted remotely on an electronic platform pursuant to Minnesota House Rule 10.01. The public can view House Rule 10.01 on the House webpage. The public can also visit the committee page on the web House site to view information on how to access this hearing with streaming video, as well as instructions on how to participate in public testimony. Members, we have two bills up today, but before we do that, we should adopt our minutes, and let me just double make sure the date. These would be minutes from our February 26th meeting. If anyone would be, any member would be kind of move so, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, I move the minutes to be adopted as written.
Very well. Representative Cleavorn moves adoption of the minutes of February 26th. Discussion? Representative Johnson, you're okay with a voice vote on this?
Voice vote is fine.
Very well. Thank you, sir. All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. In the minutes of February 26th are hereby adopted. Members, we have two bills up today. I'll be authoring both of those bills. I will not be the main presenter, however, so I will hang on to the gavel here during the presentation. Both bills are in keeping with today's theme, if you will, of State Law Enforcement Agency Policy Day. They come from the Department of Public Safety, and we have a number of public safety commissioners and staffers and directors to walk us through those bills. We're going to lay over both of these bills. They will most assuredly in one form or the other be a part of our omnibus bill that we move on in a few weeks here. So with that, members, the chair moves to refer House File 1370 to the General Register. The chair also moves an author's amendment, the DE1 amendment, and members, this puts the bill in the shape that the author wishes it to be before us. And what it is, members, is a number of separate provisions that the Department of Public Safety brought before us. And given the constraints of time for hearings and scheduling discussions as opposed to hearing several bills from the department, I decided that we will put them together into one policy bill for the department. So that's all that is, and we will have department staff walking us through those, walking us through that in a few seconds. So Representative Johnson, are you okay with a voice vote on adopting the DE1 amendment?
I am okay with that, but with the DE1 amendment, I want to mention to the chair that there's many different sections of chapter 253D and 253B, and that would require this bill to go to Health and Human Services. Those are chapters dealing with that.
Very well. We'll look at that at some point. With that, all in favor of adoption of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, and House File 1370 is amended with the DE1 amendment. Members, we'll begin walking through the bill. We'll start with Section 1, and I believe we have our Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Superintendent Drew Evans to walk us through that section and explain to us what's being proposed here. Superintendent Evans.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members. Thank you for hearing the bill today. What this first provision will do is it addresses a Supreme Court decision with our predatory offender registration program that is housed at the BCA. The state Supreme Court case was decided in April of 2020, and it is State v. Martin. What that case involved was a 1992 conviction of an out-of-state registrant out of California. That individual was convicted of sexual battery in that state at that time, served a prison sentence, and after a 1994 amendment to their state statutes, was required to register as a predatory offender. As we do in all cases in Minnesota, when an out-of-state offender moves into Minnesota, we do an analysis with the Attorney General's office to determine whether or not that individual is required to register under our current statute, which is outlined in 243, Chapter 243. In this particular instance, what the court found, the Court of Appeals upheld his requirement to register as a predatory offender. And then it went to our state Supreme Court. And what our state Supreme Court said is that they would look at the elements of a particular offense from a different state, not necessarily the facts and circumstances of the individual offense in that state. And if those facts, if those elements do not align, then that individual will be not required to register in Minnesota. This has caused an issue for us in Minnesota, and the goal of this is to create equity so that if somebody committed the same offense with the same facts and circumstances in Minnesota, that they would be required to register as a predatory offender in Minnesota. It is not designed to expand our registration system. It is simply designed to ensure equity amongst those offenses. And in particular with this Martin case, what it found is that we found the most analogous statute to be fourth degree criminal sexual conduct, which requires an element of force or coercion as an element of our offense. And that element is not present exactly in California, meaning that you would not have to prove that particular element in our statute in California, meaning it does not align. And with our statutes in Minnesota, as you know from all the your policy work that you do, a lot of our criminal sexual conduct statutes do not align well with out-of-state statutes, age for in particular. We recently had another Court of Appeals decision that is unpublished that had to do with different age brackets for what would create a particular offense in Minnesota that oftentimes do not align with other states. And so again, the entire goal of this change would be to make sure that the same conduct, if it was committed in our state, that would require registration, would require out-of-state registrants when they move to our state to register. And what this does is it's a simple change in the statute that it currently says in our statute the person was charged with or petitioned for an offense in another state that would be a violation of law as described in the paragraphs below if committed in this state. What we're changing the language to and what's being proposed is that the person charged with or petitioned for an offense in another state similar to an offense or involving similar circumstances to an offense as described in these clauses and convicted of or adjudicated delinquent for that offense and another for that offense or in another offense arising out of the same set of circumstances, meaning that if the facts and circumstances would require registration and align with one of our statutes in Minnesota, it would require registration. So that is a quick overview, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you very well. Thank you, Superintendent Evans. I should have mentioned this right off the bat. I apologize to the committee members. I'll pause after each section. Because of the, the different nature of each section so that we can have a discussion and or questions. I'll also open up the floor at the end of the bill in case it takes a little while for folks to consider what those questions or comments might be. So let me just pause right now quickly to see if any members have any questions or thoughts, comments at this point. All right, I'm not seeing any. So Superintendent, hopefully you'll still be here with us as we finish through the bill. Thank you. Section two, we have Public Safety Deputy Commissioner Cassandra O'Hearn. Welcome to the committee, Ms. O'Hearn.
Thank you, Chair Mariani, and thank you, committee members, for hearing this bill. I appreciate the opportunity to provide a few comments about it. This language is short in that what it does is it allows for the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety to accept donations, grants, bequests, and other gifts to carry out the purposes as prescribed under our enabling legislation. And the reason for needing this language is that during the time that we were working to put together the Deadly Force Encounters Working Group over a year ago, we had a number of foundations that were interested in supporting the work. And when we were working with MMB in order to accept that funding, we discovered that we did not have the authority to accept it. This was something that was both a surprise to the department, but also to MMB, because most other agencies have this language. So this language would allow the department to be able to accept this level of funding, and it's drafted to align with the other state statutes that provide for the other state agencies that have similar authority. And with that, Chair Mariani, that's all I have, unless there are questions.
Pretty simple. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Questions, thoughts, Representative Johnson?
Chair Mariani, let's see, get my screen back up where it needs to be. Deputy Commissioner O'Hare, now, law enforcement and public safety is a little different than the other agencies. We're designed out there to be neutral, to try to do our best to protect the community. I do have a little issues with these grants and funds for donations. I can think of a great example that happened up near my area back in the mid to late 70s and early 80s. Dealt with a drug runner who ended up finally getting caught when one of his planes crashed in Florida full of narcotics. A gentleman, I won't even call him a gentleman, it was Casey Ramirez. And he was doing this for a number of years, provided palm trees for the city of Princeton, purchased all the squad cars for the police department, donated them to the department, paid for the expansion of the airport so his jet plane could land there in his larger planes. Also built the hockey arena in that city. And that was all done with drug running money. At some point, he ended up getting the mayor's house, and the mayor had to go to an apartment and not live in his own home. So I'm really concerned with getting donations and stuff, especially on the public safety side of things. And I'm just wondering how the
the sheriffs, the chiefs association feel about this as well. I haven't heard anything offhand with the donations. I know they get donations for a couple programs, but they're very specific, including they received some for the DARE programs that were offered in the schools, and also some of the canine programs to help offset the cost of keeping and maintaining a dog and a canine, which over the last couple of Sundays we found are very valuable to our law enforcement community. We actually had two canines shot. One was killed in the last 2 weeks or two Sundays. So I do have concerns about accepting donations. I'm just wondering how you feel about the issues where it could be used to influence possibility in some crime families.
Ms. O'Hearn, I'm looking at line 3.20 of the amendment where it indicates that any gifts would be to carry out the purposes of this chapter. I think that provides some, guardrails and, guidance. If you could respond, and then also if you can let us know if local law enforcement individuals or groups have also commented on this. On this request, I do note that you did say that this is similar to language that exists for virtually every other agency in the state, but please, Ms. O'Hearn.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and Representative Johnson for the question. We have not heard any concerns raised from local jurisdictions, the Chiefs Association and the Sheriff's Association. I don't believe it would take away from anything that they're currently receiving, nor would it provide any additional funding to them. Like I said, we have not heard any concerns about that. All gifts and grants and things must be worked through with Minnesota Management and Budget, and there are policies and reporting requirements that are required, and that's true of all state agencies and funding that is received. And I think that's and to your comment, Chair Mariani, it does specifically tie back to the Department of Public Safety's enabling legislation for the purposes for which such monies could be received and then used.
Very well.
Chair Mariani.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah. I'm, like I say, I do have some concerns. I just want to make sure that we get in this language, not just what MMB and those policies are, but also make sure there's no strings attached to any of the donations. I'm just concerned about that because public safety, as I said, is so much different than any other department.
Very well. Well noted, and we'll continue to work on this language if we need to. Next we have, thank you, Ms. O'Hearn, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next we have Article 2, so that was Section 2 of Section 1, Article 2 presentation, and that will return to our Superintendent Drew Evans.
Thank you, Chair Mariani and members. This provision would provide alignment with the Background Check Act. And what it is, and I'm going to read this because there's a lot of words to it. The Minnesota Child Protection Background Check Act was originally passed in 1992 in response to the National Child Protection Act and Volunteers for Children Act, which went into effect in 1993. That Act was also extended, the federal act in 1994, to include those that come in contact for the safety and well-being of elderly and individuals with disabilities. In spite of that update that was created, Minnesota never updated our legislative authority in Minnesota to reflect those federal changes. And then in 2018, which is what it brings us here today, the Federal Child Protection Improvement Act was amended the NCPA/VCA further by requiring a national program that allows qualified entity to utilize the federal program instead of and bypass the state altogether. So what the suggestion is to align our state statute and our Minnesota Child Protection Background Check Act to align with the federal act. And the goal of that would be is to ensure that people are not bypassing, which would be allowed to do the BCA and our background check program. The reason that that's important is that by bypassing us and entities that you require by state statute to complete these background checks, they would not be receiving a full picture because the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension hold certain criminal history data that the FBI would not have access to. So there is situations where entities would be conducting these background checks that are required by law that would not receive the full picture that is held in the state of Minnesota. And we believe that's a good from a public policy perspective. In addition, the Department of Human Services, there has been working, in fact, language that you passed last year, if as a reminder to the committee or those that are not familiar, in order for our background check to take effect and be able to conduct a federal background check, you as the legislature need to pass a law, and then that law needs to be approved by the Attorney General of the United States. One of the recent checks that we believed would pass based on our prior experience and our advisement to the Department of Human Services did not go through. And so they are currently operating for several of their checks that are currently authorized in law that will expire in August 1st of 2021. This change would also assist with that process. So background checks you currently have in law, by making this amendment to the 299C language, would allow for those checks to continue under this authority. That being said, this does not expand any background checks. It does not change background checks. It simply ensures we have the right authority in place and that individuals are not allowed to bypass the BCA directly to the FBI so that everybody is getting a consistent background check when they're conducting them under the laws that you have passed in the state of Minnesota. And so we believe, obviously, that it's critical for this to be there so that volunteers who are working with elderly or individuals with disabilities, that they have that full picture before making that determination if they're eligible to work with those individuals.
Thank you, Superintendent Evans. It seems to me in a critical, several critical points, but one is the that the language itself does not produce an expansion of or a change to the background checks that may go partly to the question or the observation that Representative Johnson raised at the beginning, I believe, and I'll certainly be having a conversation with our Chair of Human Services to that regard. Members, questions, comments? Very well. Thank you, Superintendent. The next two articles, Article 3 and Article 4, will be presented and explained by Office of Justice Programs Director Kate Weeks. Director Weeks, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair, members. My name is Kate Weeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Office of Justice Programs. First, I'll go over Article 3. These are proposed changes to the Minnesota Crime Victim Reparations Program. Our crime victim reparations program is one of the many ways we support crime victims throughout Minnesota. Established in 1974, the Minnesota Crime Victim Reparations Board is the state's program established to help victims of violent crimes with financial losses and to aid in their recovery. Examples of losses that would be compensated under this program are funeral and burial costs, medical care, mental health, trauma healing, wage loss, loss of support for dependents. This program does not cover property loss. We bring forward these changes based on conversations with staff, stakeholders, grantees, and advocates. The first thing that our Article 3 does is change the name of the program. We are proposing changing the name to better communicate the purpose of the program to victims throughout Minnesota. The majority of other states call their program the Crime Victim Compensation Fund. We are proposing the Minnesota Crime Victim Reimbursement Program as we reimburse for losses suffered due to violent crime. The second change in Article 3 further defines what information may be used to make determinations around cooperation. Current statute provides that a victim or a claimant that failed or refused to cooperate fully with the police and other law enforcement officials would not be eligible for the benefits of this program. The proposed language we bring forward will affirmatively provide that additional information from those familiar with the case in addition to law enforcement's experience, would be used to make an eligibility determination. Under Minnesota rule governing this program, the board then has the authority to review. The final change in Article 3 is to establish that contributory misconduct determinations may not be based on current or past affiliation with a particular group. Minnesota statute provides that an award may be denied or reduced to the extent that the board deems reasonable because of the contributory misconduct of the claimant or victim. Minnesota rule that governs this program goes further by allowing the board to deny or reduce by 25% the award due to the claimant victim being a confirmed member or associate of a gang or hate group. We are bringing forward this proposal due to conversations with advocates and providers and through re-examining our program for barriers that may preclude access. So in conversations we've had this past year with individuals, we learned that there are groups of individuals who would greatly benefit from this program, such as experiencing lost wages, need for health care, need for trauma and mental health recovery, but they simply don't apply because they believe they will be denied because they are labeled as a gang member or denied benefits because of an associate. As director of this program, we work closely with staff, and one of the things that really bothered me is the whole point of this program is to really help those that have suffered a loss due to a violent crime. And oftentimes the benefits of this program help in that healing. And so we were trying to figure out ways that we can reduce those barriers. And this is one of the ways that we would like to do that. But I would also like to remind the committee that this proposal in Article 3, it keeps in place the current statute that denies awards due to contributory misconduct. So if someone is actively committing a crime or actively engaged in actions that cause their harm that they're now seeking help for, they will not receive benefits from this program. And that it concludes the changes we propose in Article 3.
Very well. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariano, I want to thank the testifier for bringing this forward. I thought that's a great program. It helps those that really need the help. One concern I have is that changes to the fact of assisting law enforcement. I just want to make sure, and if I get this right with the victim advocates group, they still have to provide assistance for law enforcement to get the conviction and that work with the prosecutors to during the court trials and getting the conviction, but that during the sentencing part of it where an advocate group could read a letter from that person and not so they don't have to confront the convicted person again. Because without the victim's assistance in the investigation and the prosecution, it's going to be very difficult to get a conviction.
Very well. Representative Justin, are you looking for a response from Ms. Weeks or just sharing?
I'm looking for a response if that was the intent.
Oh, very well. Ms. Weeks.
Chair Mariani, Representative Johnson, we are not changing the requirement at all that cooperation is required in order to receive benefits. We want to affirmatively establish in statute that it's clear that victims can also provide information from professionals along that criminal justice spectrum that they're working with that are familiar with their claim as well, so that multiple sources of information can be presented to make determinations.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson, you're through? I believe so.
Yes, I am.
All right, thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the thought was maybe to bring this up after the next section, but I wonder if it may be, with permission, if this would be an okay time to bring this up now, that this article in your bill, Mr. Chair, I was actually in a bill of mine, House File, and I'm confirming the exact, it's House File 1789. The department had asked me to carry that and then ended up getting incorporated into your bill. And in putting that together, I had just some revisions to the language in mind. And so the A1 amendment was posted. It was posted after the deadline. And so I think, Mr. Chair, the intent was not to necessarily have a vote on that, but I just wanted to call the committee's attention to that. that if this language were to move forward, this was some language I've worked out with Officer Justice Programs and this week's Director Weeks to just clean this up a little bit. And so I want to make sure to call folks' attention to that. It does not, it really shouldn't change the substance a great deal, but I wanted to make sure that the wording was just a little tighter on a couple points. And that, again, is contained in the A1 amendment that's posted on the committee website. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anything more you want to add at this point in terms of substance to it? Or we might as well just go ahead and have that vetting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so members, really, what it does is two things. The section that Lee Johnson was just asking about, which is on page 12 of the delete all amendment, talks about how, as Director Weeks said, this wouldn't change at all the standard that of the victim or claimant regarding cooperation. It simply talks about how the cooperation is determined. And it seemed to me, and talking to Director Weeks as well, that we want to have allow for a broad a review of information. You'll see the language in the A1 amendment, a review of information available from law enforcement prosecutors, other professionals familiar with the case. It may be, for example, that it may not be a formal police report. I think right now there's an officer can complete a form. And I was concerned that we want to make sure that however that cooperation is going to be demonstrated, that be the case. And then on page 13, line 19, the reference that was made regarding affiliation in certain groups, we want to make sure that that again, the focus on that is really on the contributory misconduct, that if the claimant has contributed misconduct, that the reimbursement could be denied or reduced, but that misconduct cannot be based simply on the affiliation with the group. So again, this is just some cleanup language in both cases. If it seems appropriate with the chair, and otherwise, we certainly could look to add this on now. And otherwise, I wanted to highlight it so that if it does move forward, we could make sure that it's included at that time.
Yeah, we're gonna lay this over. So I think it's appropriate for us to technically make sure we're sound that we can move on it at that time. I'm wondering if Ms. Weeks, anything you want to add to Representative Pinto's comments and to the A1 amendment.
Chair Mariani, members, I don't. We've been in close contact with Representative Pinto and will continue to work with the committee through this process.
And so, Ms. Weeks, no advice or thoughts to the committee on these issues, or you're still collecting your thoughts on it, I suppose, or the department is?
With members, we believe that Representative Pinto's amendment does not change the intent of what we're trying to accomplish, so we are fine with the amendment.
Got it. All right. Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I want to make sure to highlight it for when it does come up, just to make sure we didn't drop it. So, yeah, and I developed it in concert with the office. And so I guess, so I'm glad to know that it's approved in that way. Thank you.
Good. All right. Article 4, Director Weeks.
Chair members, Article 4 provides updates to post-conviction crime victim rights provisions. The Office of Justice Programs Crime Victim Justice Unit performs the role of Crime Victim Ombudsman for the state of Minnesota. Crime victims have a number of rights outlined in Minnesota statute that our office works to educate, train, and enforce. The following changes come from our work with victims and the criminal justice system in ensuring that these rights are known and upheld. First, the proposed changes in Article 4 ensure that victims understand that their rights to be notified of certain post-conviction rights like expungement and civil commitments and what steps need to be taken to receive those notifications. Crime victim rights in Minnesota happen along a continuum during the criminal justice process. So this is looking at ensuring that victims know of their rights during that process. Article 4 achieves this by requiring prosecutors to provide notice to victims of their post-conviction rights at the same time that they provide their current notice of the disposition of a case. And then subsequently, Article 4 eliminates the requirement for the courts to notify victims of these rights, as the court generally does not have victim contact information. In order to support this change, OJP will create a model notification to be used by prosecutors. The second change that we are proposing in Article 4 clarifies current provisions related to victim notification concerning civil commitments to make clear in statute that the prosecutor in the court of in the county of conviction notifies the victim of the petition for a civil commitment, that the Department of Human Services notifies the victim upon release from civil commitment, and the Department of Corrections notifies the victim of release from prison. The responsibilities and steps the victim must take to receive these notifications does not change. It's just making clear who is responsible for which notification. Chair members, that concludes Article 4.
Very well. Representative Fuad.
Chair, my question goes back to the previous, just some clarification, but I can wait till the total end if that would work better for you, or do you
want me to? No, that's fine. Go for it.
Ms. Weeks, I'm new to this whole public safety part and community policy, and maybe Representative Johnson can help with this because he has experience in this, but I'm a little confused. So if a victim of sexual abuse does not cooperate, like a child or an adolescent, with the prosecution, they will not be entitled to any kind of services through the fund? Is that what I'm hearing, or am I getting this wrong?
Ms. Weeks. Director Weeks.
Yeah, Chair, members, Representative Hewitt, the Crime Victim Reparations Fund does provide services to victims of sexual assault and their families. So this wouldn't change any of those that eligibility.
Representative Hewitt.
So even if they could not, just for psychological reasons, cooperate with the prosecution or with the investigators, which I know is, and I get it, it's real hard to prove a case, but there's other circumstances here, they would still be eligible for funding or for help through the fund.
Ms. Weeks, Director Weeks.
Yeah, Chair, Representative Hewitt. Yes, actually the changes that we're proposing in this legislation actually probably ensures even more that benefits would be eligible, because we're allowing other people that would be supporting that child and that family to also submit information about cooperation. So it actually helps those victims as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe we're toward the end of the presentation of this bill, and if that's the case, I'd like to just point out one of the things that's shocking to me, I don't even know if it's shocking anymore, but I'd like to see more. I would like to see something. There are no police reforms in this policy presentation. And I know that we had the recommendation of the joint law enforcement and the Attorney General's office and DPS, and you had those recommendations. I know that report is not done yet, so I would like to know when that's gonna be done. But that report was before we had a global event in this state, right in the city of Minneapolis, sparked protests around the world, seeing a lot of change in other states. But I'm very concerned that this policy proposal doesn't have any reforms, not one, that can speak to this moment that we're in with a sense of urgency that we need right now for the members of the communities that have been harmed. And I know that, Mr. Evans, you sit on the post board, so you could bring some recommendations in that perch to the post board. That's one way you could do it. But I'm just curious as to, are we going to see any recommendations?
Yeah, Representative Frazier, I had a conversation with the commissioner yesterday making the same observation about this. Oh, there's the commissioner. Very well. Good. Commissioner, I believe this one's better directed at you. I was just starting to say that you and I had a quick conversation last night where I made pretty much similar observations, Representative Frazier, and not knowing what the intent was of the department in terms of continuing or bringing forward any proposals in addition to these policy proposals before us. But I believe you've heard the question, and welcome, and please provide your thoughts on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm John Harrington. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, and I was one of the co-chairs of the Deadly Force Encounters Working Group with Attorney General Keith Ellison. As part of the Deadly Force Encounters Working Group, there were 12 action steps and 28 recommendations that were part of a proposal that we launched actually last year. The final report has been held up due to COVID, but we are, in fact, we met with the entire working group last week to try and make sure that we were all on the right same page with that. Since the working group's proposals have moved forward, I can tell you that there were four proposals that involved the post board, and all four of those have already been enacted during last summer's special session. There were 15 proposals for the Department of Public Safety. Seven of them have already been completed. Three are in progress, and the five that are outstanding were things that required additional funding that the Department of Public Safety did not have, such as a statewide study and implementation of body cams across all police departments, creating a sentinel group that would do, like the National Transportation Safety Board, who would review all deadly force encounters to make sure that they could be reviewed independently from the criminal investigation and or the police investigation. There were 12 for the legislature, eight of which have been completed already. The three of the ones that are outstanding are, in fact, things that once again required some additional funding. Of the 12 action steps, nine have been completed by the Department of Public Safety, and there are three in progress at this time. And we are continuing to have conversations with both the working group and with community agencies to look at what next steps there shall be. So one example of this was that we changed the deadly force statute in and of itself in last summer during the special session. That change went into effect. In fact, I think it went into effect Monday. March 1st was when that change went into effect. And we spent the last several months working with law enforcement and the post board to create the training to make sure that all departments would have adequate training on that by the March 1st deadline, which we did accomplish. I certainly recognize that this bill, which has been more focused on, for example, missing and murdered Indigenous women, sex crimes, and other cases, has shifted from the Deadly Force Encounters Working Group. But I certainly can support and would be happy to engage with you and your committee what other next steps you would like to see beyond the 28 recommendations and the action steps. As I said, many of them are still in progress. We're in actually operational planned with some of them, you know, including, for example, the independent agency within the BCA, the victim services representative at the BCA. So many of those things are already done, and we're open to having a conversation about next steps and where else we should be going with this.
And so, Commissioner, the working group is still meeting, or are they the working group you referenced, the Deadly Force working group, are they still convening?
We have, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have not reconvened the working group for an active session other than to review recommendations and to talk about next steps in terms of what else they would like to do. So we have not taken additional testimony or taken additional action. So, but the working group, as we convened it, and we said this at the very beginning, was going to be an ongoing process. It was not going to be a one and done where we were expected to be done. So, in fact, Representative Moran met with us last week to talk about the things she would like to see and some of the items that were in the special session this summer where there were things still left there that we were not able to accomplish, and her hope that we were going to be able to take up some of those things as we went forward during this legislative session.
Representative Fraser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate that. I think the working group is great. I'm a little disappointed to hear that it hasn't reconvened during that time, especially considering that Mr. Floyd lost his life in between the time that you had the recommendation report that has gone out. You know, I guess what I'm looking for is, you know, what is the response going to be to a black man having a life pressed out of him in the streets of Minneapolis that has sparked a global reaction to this, right? What is the response going to be from our Department of Safety? I mean, I think about the bills that have come through this committee. I had an anti-white supremacy bill. That's something that could be jumped. That's something that could be supported. That's something that could be moved forward. That's something that gives tools to root out certain factions within our police department, our law enforcement departments that are harmful to communities. So I'm looking for actions, particularly in this moment. I'm looking for a sense of urgency. And I'm looking for actions that are going to speak to what the problem is today. And I'm hoping we can get some answers around that.
Well, Representative Frazier, you know, there is a new focus, if you will, that I believe will come into you know, into this conversation relatively soon, because we're scheduled to begin the trial of those accused of the murder of George Floyd, you know, last year. I fully anticipate that the kind of questions that you and others are posing, and I've had them posed to me as well recently, are only going to sharpen and come from lots of places. I fully expect there to be national focus on, you know, the trial in Minneapolis. I suspect there'll be international curiosity and focus as well. And I do think it is critically important for our state to be able to have a strong, determined response, you know, to those questions that are you know, strong and hopefully reflect, you know, a good commitment that cuts across both the executive branch and the legislative branch, you know, working to modernize our statutory approach, as well as, you know, as the commissioner shared, to be able to be very assertive with the use of our existing authority through, you know, administrative law and executive actions.
Mr. Chair?
Commissioner.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Frazier, I will can say that, you know, the bill that your committee pushed through during special session, at the time we pushed it through, most states had done reducing or eliminating the chokehold and requiring officers to intervene. We did that, sanctity of life, changed the deadly force statute, incorporated a police response to mental health, increased police accountability through the post board, increased community participation in the post board, and so much more. The special session bill that wasn't in no small part in response to the murder of George Floyd was three or four times as expansive as any other legislation that I've seen in the United States during that time frame. And we'll, in all candor, it doesn't go as far as we would like it to go. But there was a point where we got as much as we could, we thought, during the special session in that summer to try and get something in law as soon as possible. And then we moved into trying to move into implementation phase so that it wasn't simply a law that was on a book, but was in fact a law that actually had actual real activity behind it. So trying to get, you know, more body cams out there so we can hold officers accountable and also clear officers when they're doing the right thing, making sure that all officers understand that whole idea of sanctity of life, and that they have an absolute duty to intervene if another George Floyd situation was to come up, that they have a legal duty to intervene, and that to not do so is actionable. I am absolutely committed to working with your committee and others to look at what other next steps we can do. I can tell you that from the perspective of the working group that spent a year looking at this, working with other departments that had actually done, I think, some similar work, Minnesota has a lot to say that we have accomplished. And that doesn't mean, and I can promise this from my personal perspective and from the Attorney General's perspective, having talked to him just recently, we do not believe this conversation can end until we see the numbers and we see the behavior go down. And so I would be very open to having this conversation either with members of your committee or others to continue to have to look at what other next steps there are. There were a few things left from the special session that were still in conversation. Some of them were not really germane or part of the Department of Public Safety, but I will absolutely commit to us continuing the conversation and taking this as wherever we can go to try and reduce and eliminate as much of the deadly force encounters as we possibly can.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate that. You know, what I would like to say is that that was legislation that was in large part brought by the Policy Caucus. But, you know, with your executive authority, you don't have to wait for us to bring legislation. You don't need permission to do the right thing and respond in a moment and do what needs to be done. And I'll go back again. I know that Mr. Evans sits on the Post Board, so I'll be looking for some type of action to move forward, particularly to respond to things that are happening right now during this moment. I ask this question of every executive that comes in. What are you doing with your executive authority to make change? That doesn't need legislation to move, but with your executive authority, what are you doing to root out, clean up and close and remove some of these inequities that we have and stop the disparate outcomes? I'm gonna pose that same question to you. I'll leave you with that. I know the DLC commissioner committed to doing things and there I see them doing things. I'm gonna ask that same question to you, Mr. Commissioner. And I'll leave you with that.
Well, and appropriately so, Representative Frazier, it is the role of the legislative branch to be able to press our executive branch with the authorities that we have together made, real and possible. Representative Hollins, I believe on this point.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you so much. I think really Representative Frazier stole the words right out of my mouth is what can we do with executive power? How can we as legislators help support what you want to see accomplished? I'm carrying a bill to ban no-knock warrants. And it's embarrassing that there are a number of states that have already passed this and that we, although we're on the forefront of this and although we are the point, state where George Floyd was murdered, where Philando Castile was killed, that we are lagging behind these other states and the work that they're doing. And so if there's anything that we can do on our end to make this go forward, to push you on this, I would just strongly encourage and ask you, what can we do on our end to make sure that we're making moves on this and that we're not falling behind the rest of the country.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Hollins. And I do think that that bill is on its way to, that particular bill you mentioned on warrants is on its way to our committee shortly. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members. Just want to do a couple quick comments and then get back to what we were doing, dealing with mostly child victims, young victims, and victims of sexual assault with this department policy bill. First of all, I want to thank Director Evans for him and his staff. They've had a very long week and a half. For those of you who don't know what's happened in the last week and a half, we've had four suspects killed in law enforcement-involved shootings, two officers wounded, a canine officer wounded, and a canine officer killed. The officers did not go after them looking to kill them. The officers want to protect every single life they can. These individuals came out shooting at law enforcement officers. Law enforcement responded. They didn't want to do that. It changes their life forever. I've been involved in an officer-involved shooting, and I will tell you, it changes your life forever. And I'm also disappointed what I heard here from Representative Hollins, asking the executive branch to do our duties. Very disappointed. Because you can't get something done the way you want to. You want the executive branch to do it. That's our responsibility. We give them limited authority to make some rules and rule changing, but that's our responsibility. And that is to work together to do the changes that everybody believes is the right changes. Not just what you think, not just what somebody on your side, but everybody. Things are different in greater Minnesota than they are in the metro. But unfortunately, the crime aspects that are in the metro are now coming out in the greater Minnesota, and people in greater Minnesota are concerned. In greater Minnesota, the best part of the state, we respect our law enforcement officers and we help them. We work with them. Unlike down here where they're trying to destroy the law enforcement community and you have crime going skyrocketing and most individuals are coming into our neighborhoods and we're frustrated. But I'm going to get back to what we came here to do, and that's to talk about the department policy bill, mostly dealing with children, mostly dealing with victims of sexual assault. We want to help those victims the best we can. And this bill does a lot of that. But unfortunately, this is the section that, because it makes changes and makes requirements for health and human service personnel under their purview on 253B and 253D, this section does, this is the area that needs to go to HHS for review. And I'm going to ask the chair as we move this forward that we move it without recommendation at this time to Health and Human Services so they can deal with those issues and send it back here so we can finish the bill. Thank you.
Representative Johnson, I will certainly be communicating with the chair of Human Services. I did emphasize Superintendent Evans' testimony of the changes not expanding or deepening or changing our checks, background checks. But if those chairs wish to see this bill, I will certainly honor that. We're going to be laying this bill over today, so we're not going to move it. I think your observations just evoked a few responses, so I do want to get to those in a second. I do want to remind members that all members here are representatives of the people of Minnesota, and so it's not just our ideas that we bring. We also bring the advice and counsel and often the desires of the people that we represent. And I certainly do think it's absolutely appropriate that we use all our tools that we've created here and passing statutes, making statutes and formal lawmaking in that way is only one of the things that we do as being responsible for the governance of the state. It's absolutely appropriate for members, especially for the legislative branch, to constantly press the executive branch to be able to exercise the authorities that have been conferred upon it through prior legislation. But with that, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. I'll be very brief. Representative Johnson, I believe it is directly in the post board's purview to regulate policing, and asking them to do their job is not unheard of, and it's not inappropriate. They can regulate things like no-knock warrants. We know this is true, and that is exactly what I'm asking of them. No more, no less. Thank you.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I was going to respond to that, too, but I think Representative Hollins did a great job of responding. We're asking the executive branch to do what it was within their authority, nothing more. I would say not much has been done, but we're asking them to do what was then within their authority, not to wait on the legislators to do something, but to do what is within their authority. And I also would like to say, Just for a second, I'll step off on the off-ramp that Representative Johnson took was, this divisive rhetoric around urban, metro versus greater Minnesota, it's not true. It's just not true. We are working to ensure that we have a public safety system that is safe for everyone. That's in a metro, that's in greater Minnesota, that's around this entire state. When I was elected and I took an oath, it is for the oath for every citizen, every resident, everyone that lives in the state of Minnesota. So everything I do, that is the lens that I use. Not to harm anyone, but to make lives better for everyone within this state. So I'm tired of the divisive rhetoric and this pitting the metro versus greater Minnesota. It's just simply not true. And that's not what we're trying to do. This committee is here to create a system that is safe for everyone.
Thank you, Representative Frazier. Representative Bentall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just, I want to agree with those comments just made. And in particular, there was one phrase that I heard Lee Johnson use that I guess I thought that particularly concerned me. I want to make sure we identify, which is what I heard him say is that people in the Metro are, quote, attempting to destroy law enforcement, was a phrase that I heard. And I just, I will just note how problematic and concerning I think that is to an extreme degree on many, many levels. And I'm kind of imagining flipping that around and a statement going in different directions. I won't even say the different formulations I have in mind, but I'll simply note some statements that could be made about some groups in our society attempting to destroy other groups. I think that that is, I think that that is not acceptable. And I would really ask that, that language like that not be used. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I do agree we need to be careful with language that, you know, could suggest to, in a sentence that that we should be separate from one another. I certainly did work and will continue to work, Representative Bentall, to make sure that we're hearing diverse voices throughout the state. We had a powerful, I thought, series of hearings a couple of weeks ago where we reached out to diversity of people within geographic parts of the state that we don't often hear from because of, you know, distance and those kind of issues. But I thought it was incredibly powerful for us to be reminded of the big differences in diversity of our state. And quite frankly, I was I learned a lot, and I was also encouraged by more by the, what we have in common as opposed to the, those things that we don't have in common. And I'm awfully proud of many of our law enforcement folks out in greater Minnesota that I don't often get a chance to hear, just as I'm proud of those that are here, as well as community members who are expecting a good accountability from all law enforcement communities. Representative Clevarn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And since my colleagues have addressed the issue of the fact that there are many of us, I would say all of us on this committee, on both sides of the table, who want to have a good public safety system in our state, I will not address that issue. But the issue that I would like to bring forward is the false narrative, and I'll repeat that, the false narrative that if we work in conjunction with the executive branch, that we are somehow abdicating our responsibilities as legislators. That is not a true statement. The piece that I would like for this committee to focus on is the work. And that work is three branches of government working in concert to protect and serve the people of our state. And if we focus on that work, and leave the negative rhetoric in the trash can where it belongs, we can do really good work for our communities. And so I am asking one more time for this committee to be open to hear all the voices in the room, whether it's the testifiers, the legislators, or anyone else who comes before us. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Clevarn. You know, years ago, I had a, it got to be a decade now, more. I had a colleague who was running for governor, and we had an interesting conversation where part of the conversation was sort of along the lines of, hey, when I become governor, you're just going to be really aligned and the person didn't say you're going to do what I want to do, but you know, it was sort of along those lines. And I looked at my good friend and so, you know, I really do wish you become governor, but quite honestly, once you're in the executive branch, look for tough expectations of me and tough accountability, you know, frameworks. That's my role as a state legislator, and that doesn't change just because I have a good friend who's in the executive branch. I think our design, there's wisdom in our design where we maturely challenge one another to consistently push and pursue the common values that we have and always deliver good governance. Very well. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to echo the sentiments of Representative Claiborne regarding negative rhetoric. I really strongly wish that the negative rhetoric would end, but I'm concerned about the continuing negative rhetoric and then those that choose to look past it and be silent. In my own community, I've had people come out and spew their hate and their negative rhetoric. I've seen the headlines on the news where our colleagues in the Minnesota House have gone out to suburbs and spewed their negative, hateful rhetoric threatening law enforcement officers. And I'm supposed to look past that and think that they have some kind of a willingness or an interest in collaborating for the future and the betterment of Minnesotans and law enforcement? No way. Threatening law enforcement to burn suburbs down? When I see Governor Walz allow the attack to happen on our Capitol and then call Republicans everything about Republicans, I can't remember the exact quote offhand, but something about Republicans had bad ideas. Is that a negative rhetoric? You know, that's the kind of stuff that we in the legislative branch, and we're supposed to have confidence in Governor Walz and the executive branch and their decision-making. No, the negative rhetoric has come from Governor Walz and those that are emboldened to be the copycats of the negative rhetoric. It's so incredibly frustrating and disingenuous. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. I certainly would join you in challenging any of our members that would, if at any point, suggest that violence is something that we ought to engage in. I certainly do not join in, attacking our public servants, whatever stripes. I will always expect strong accountability from them all, but I think we probably have more common ground than that. With that, members,
we're Chair Mariani.
Representative Johnson.
I'm going to ask all the members if we can get back on track and get to work on these bills because they are important for the victims of crimes. And we are running short on time to do the next bill.
Very well. Good advice. I was going to move us forward here. I do want to thank the department for bringing us a series of bills that does, I think, some good work on victims' rights. As I mentioned, I did have a conversation with the commissioner that these kind of issues will certainly come up before us today. As at this point, these are the only policy bills that are coming forward. With that, members, we will considering these proposals again shortly as we put together a omnibus bill out of this committee. And so the chair at this point the chair will lay over House File 1370 as amended. Members, the chair moves to refer House File 1366 to the General Register. House File 1366 is before us. We have, this is the chair's bill. This is a bill that comes from our Peace Officer Standards and Training Board. And to tell us about the bill are both the Post Board Executive Director, Eric Missel, as well as the Post Board Chair, Chief Kelly McCarthy. Welcome to you both. Please state your name for the record and tell us about House File 1366.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Eric Misselt. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Post Board. I appreciate the committee's time, and I will try and keep this as brief and succinct as I can. So the first section one of the bill refers to the public, or I'm sorry, data practices section regarding licensing data 13.41. And what that is a request by us to change certain data from private to public, and then and also protect some other data. So this subdivision classifies data that identifies a licensee's employer as private. We believe this is unnecessary, as anyone can go to an agency website or ask for the information from an agency and get a staff list, see who the chief or sheriff is, et cetera. For example, currently when the post board sends out data requests and information as innocuous as the annual data on complaints or policy compliance to the public, we have to redact the name of the chief or sheriff or individual that submitted that data because of this statute. I checked with numerous stakeholders and those with historical knowledge of POST, and to date, no one's been able to tell me why this would be considered private, and we really believe that where a person, the agency a person works for or a licensee works for, should be public. The second piece of this section does then identify the problem that the current statute only protects the home addresses of licensees for obvious reasons, but it does not protect their personal emails or phone numbers. So aside from the clear security issues that could be impacted by the release of this personal data, the Post Board relies on email communication with licensees to conduct business. And if this data is not protected, it is likely that licensees, including inactive licensees who we do try to keep track of, will withhold this information and impact our ability to carry out our business in an efficient and secure manner. And I think it's just fair to say that none of us would want our personal emails out there floating or personal phone numbers. And obviously when the statute was written, emails didn't exist. So that's section one in a nutshell.
Very well, Director Missel. You know, when I first started working professional, we didn't have emails. We didn't even have computers. And a lot has obviously changed. But with that, you know, comes some pretty important considerations that we had just not thought about, particularly when it comes to, you know, the privacy nature, you know, of data. And the expectations of how people now regularly communicate with one another. Chair McCarthy, are you with us? I don't see her on the list. She may not be with us. All right, very well. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Director Missel, thank you for being here. I just wanted to point out the one issue with section one that we just went through, dealing with quite a bit of data. Dealing with chapter 13, my suggestion to the chair is to have this bill sent over to judiciary to deal with this. I don't want to spend a lot of time on the floor when it comes forward, because with Chapter 13 and the changes in the data that's turned to private and data that's currently private turned to turned to public data, I think the Judiciary Committee dealing with Chapter 13 needs to hear this, at least this section. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Oh, I'm sorry. Anyone else? And I apologize, members. I'm actually checking with staff around this issue of judiciary and private data. All right, very well. I do, members, I do meet, and or my staff meet regularly with the Judiciary Committee in order to raise these kind of issues, because we have bills that often kind of gray and fall in each other's, you know, could fall in each other's jurisdiction. And it isn't like we only have a few bills to hear in either committee. And so my staff's telling me that, in fact, they, in those conversations, they waived seeing this. We're not expecting controversy, as you know, Director Missel. I think part of what's happening here is that we're making more data private and not less. And typically, when you've got these contentious issues, is when we're opening up, you know, what has been carefully considered as private, you know, into the public sphere. Director Missel, I think you already said this, but it seems to me that you've been vetting with all sorts of stakeholders that there doesn't seem to be any complaints or concerns. Or, and in fact, I think you said folks were kind of wondering, why do we have, you know, that classification in the first place?
Yes, that's in fact the case. As with some of the post statutes, and in fact, another one we're going to be discussing shortly, nobody can really pinpoint why why it was written the way it was. So.
Okay, very well. Well, members, if there are no further questions, my intent is to also lay this bill over so that we'll consider it. And Representative, or rather, Director Missel?
So next section, that's what you'd like me to cover then, Ms.
I'm sorry. You know, I should have, I was picking up on a cue from you, but I couldn't quite figure it out. There is another section, isn't there?
There's a couple more, yeah.
Yes. Director Missel.
No worries. Okay, so section two, really this one is just cleaning up chapter, 214, statute 214.10, subdivision 11. During the reform legislation was passed last year, it was passed that the Complaint Investigation Committee, which currently is three members of the board, would move to four, with three peace officer members and then one public member. But because of the way the legislation was written, that was put in place, so this basically brings 214 in conformity with 66.843 subdivision 1B, makes it clear and allows me to make the necessary rule change to reflect 214 and change the membership of the Complaint Investigation Committee.
Very well. Let's take a pause and see if there are any questions at this point. All right. Clear as mud, Director.
All right. Section three. This deals with 66.842, which is post-board terms and vacancies. Under Chapter 214, board members are automatically continue when their terms expire if the governor's office does not appoint a replacement. If June 30th of the year the member expires, comes and goes without an appointment, that member is automatically renewed for another 4 years. And that is applicable generally in 214 to all licensing and executive boards across the spectrum. However, this is what I referenced earlier. For whatever reason, and we're not clear why this was carved out back in the day, but for some unknown reason, current post board statute carves out certain positions on the board as not being subject to 214 regarding how these positions expire and are renewed. As a result, we have the positions covered are peace officers, PPOE, administrators, public members, and the small jurisdiction elected official. They are automatically expired under current law and removed from the board upon expiration, regardless of whether an appointment's been made or not. What this has happened in the past, and that's what brought it to light, similar to testimony earlier on a different bill from one of the testifiers. Nobody really kind of knew about it, and it popped up in 2020. And as a result, we end up with positions that are vacant for a long period of time. until the board, the governor can make the appointments. And as you know, they make hundreds and hundreds of appointments every year. So that can be problematic and impact our ability to conduct business with appropriate representation. So, and again, I checked with folks historically, legally, and no one's exactly sure why that's there or why the post board was carved out or why these positions were carved out any differently than any other board in the state. So this would rectify that situation, and all appointments would fall under 214 like they do for everybody else.
Well, and Director Mislin, I could certainly see where, you know, under certain circumstances, say you had other members, you know, who simply, you know, resigned or for whatever reason couldn't be at the board any further. And then you combine it with this, you know, kind of, you know, I don't know what you call this, you know, missing period. We could wind up with a board, you know, less capable of, or perhaps even incapable of carrying out its purpose. So this certainly does make sense to me. Very well. Continue. If I see hands up, I'll call out people.
All right. Sounds good. Well, we're on the final one at any rate. So the final section, and of course, I lost my place. Okay. Yes. This one's very straightforward. The advisory council appointments for the new advisory council was created in the reform legislation. The statute that was quoted referred to the ombudsperson for families and created some confusion as to who those appointments should be made by, or who should make those appointments. And the chair and I had discussed this, and the intent was that the ethnic boards would be the ones making those appointments. So this is simply a change in the reference of the statute, and it refers to the boards themselves, does not involve the ombudspersons, and clears that up so that all of the four ethnic councils can make those appointments, or the appointments can be made to the advisory council by those boards, and it does not necessitate going through the ombudsperson for families.
Well, and I, as one of the original architects of the language, that was certainly my intent. We wound up, unfortunately, you know, creating, as you know, as well you described, you know, unnecessary several steps here. You know, with having the wrong, if you will, citation of, you know, who's appointing. Because those bodies are reporting and relating back to those ethnic councils at any rate. It's pretty well. Members, any questions, thoughts, comments? All right, Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make one final comment here before everyone leaves and disinfect, because the post board is here. And I know I mentioned the post board a couple of times when I was talking to the commissioner, and I do realize that the DPS does not control the post board. But Mr. Missel, since you are here, I would like to say I hope you take that information, this conversation, back to individuals at the post board. And I know that I'm hopeful with the audit that happened. I think that was good. I think that could lead to good things. I'm also hopeful with the new database is going to be put in place. I think that could lead to some very, very good training for our law enforcement officer, which I think law enforcement officers rank and file would say that's an important thing for them. I think it will lead there. I think we can get there with that database. And I will say with the community board that we have now, I think that is also very, very positive. And I know that they are bringing some recommendations to the post board, and I'm hoping that the post board will act on those in a timely fashion. I know there's some recommendations around First Amendment issues, and I know there's recommendations around anti-white supremacy as well. So I'm hoping that those things will be taken up and discussed and moved on in a timely fashion. So thank you for being here.
Well, and Director Missel, I think the board has a meeting coming up soon. Is it this month or next month? I can't recall.
The next scheduled meeting is April 22nd. The advisory council did pass out of the council meeting yesterday a request for an earlier meeting to consider some of the proposals that came out of the advisory council. Chair McCarthy and I will be discussing that. She can order a special meeting or emergency meeting, but that's not been determined yet. The next one is scheduled currently for April 22nd, I believe.
Okay, very well. Well, Representative Missel, thank you for the presentation. Thank you for the work that you do with our Pulse board. You've been with the board for, forget how many years now, not terribly long, I believe.
Since 2017, I started as assistant. Yeah,
right, and now you're our executive there. So thank you for providing leadership to an important board. Clearly, there's an interest on the part of the legislature to have a good, strong Pulse board, continuing to drive, you know, excellence and accountability for our licensed peace officers in our state. Director Miss, I'll be laying over House File 1366, and we will come back to it in a few weeks as we begin to construct the committee bill. So members, the chair lays over House File 1366. Members, that's all I have for today. We will have a busy day the next time we meet. And doggone it, you know, I had the list of bills up before me and I lost them. We will be meeting in our regular meeting time, and then we're going to have an evening meeting as well. As I shared with committee members, it's certainly not my intent to have a lot of evening meetings. I'm hoping this will be the only one, quite frankly. Some of you who served in the past know that we had quite a few evening meetings in the last 2 years. The physical nature of those meetings as opposed to, you know, this virtual made that possible. And I think to a large degree desirable, much more difficult to pull off on this platform. So we're trying to be super efficient with how we proceed. My hope, members, is that by virtue of doing this evening meeting on Thursday and having a fairly assertive agenda over the next several meetings, that we'll be able to create some good workable space for all committee members as the session enters into that final deadline week, where many of us are going to be dragged into multiple meetings that are going to be overlapping. And hopefully we're not one of those by virtue of doing all this hard work up front. So with that, members, until our next committee meeting on Thursday, this committee stands adjourned.